From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I suspect I'm not alone when I say that weather extremes in recent growing seasons have made me feel a bit like a stranger in a strange land in my own garden, wondering what will bloom when and when to do what, and most of all, wondering what madness is coming next. Managing our gardens, and especially its longest-lived residents, our trees, in changing times is our topic today. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Today's guest is Daniel Witosh, the arboriculture supervisor at Cornell Botanic Gardens in Ithaca, New York, where he and his colleagues care for the woody plants at the 30-acre botanic garden, plus a 100-acre arboretum and about 3,600 acres of natural areas. Like plant people everywhere, they've been feeling their way through the impacts of a shifting climate and extreme weather events. And now that winters are somewhat milder, even experimenting with adding some new plants to the collection. I'm so glad he's joining us today to share some of those insights. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Good afternoon, Margaret. I'm excited to chat with you.
Yeah. Well, after I talked to you for a recent New York Times garden column, I have to say, I felt relieved in a way that, you know, there's that sort of brotherhood feeling or whatever, you know, that sort of, you know, camaraderie that even at your level at the Botanic Garden, you guys are also having to figure your way through. And I think that's good for other gardeners listening to hear. You know, it feels a little unfamiliar out there at the moment.
Yeah.
What's the biggest thing there in the last couple of seasons and so forth? Is it the change in rain patterns or is it heat? Or what's the thing for you at Cornell up in Ithaca?
It's probably two main things for me in the trees anyways. One is that earlier and longer season, so longer at both ends. And two is just unreliable water. It is feast or famine frequently. We low snowpack coming into spring, it drought very early, and then it might pour later in the season. So yeah, water management and just changes from the norms.
Yeah, you said longer, you know, season at both ends, sort of. And I keep wondering what it's like to be like a bud or, you know, parts of a plant that in the old days, I'll say, you know, we used to have a proper winter and first there was a fall that preceded it that gradually got cooler. You know, that things used to sort of, we would say, harden off. And then at the other end, they kind of gradually wake up and I feel like, oh my goodness, it's like, woo, woo, 0 to 100, 0 to 100, 0 to 100. Do you know what I mean?
Literally, temperature wise, sometimes for sure.
But also just what, how does that, I mean, it must just change the sort of protective layers, so to speak, you know, on those parts of the plants that are, they must be so vulnerable and so forth. It's just.
For sure. You know, leaves that are emerging, they haven't yet formed the cuticle to help them resist the sun. So if we have less cloud cover, a lot of heat, and that can cause some foliar damage for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So learning to read the signals, you know, when we did the Times story, we were talking about how, you know, I've been gardening a long time. And so to me, I kind of always knew, oh, around, you know, Memorial Day, I do thus and such. And around, you know, I had an association with the calendar and certain garden activities or bloom times or whatever. And that's all kind of off, not happening exactly that way anymore. And when you and I talked about kind of learning to read the signals, instead being a little more of an observer, a more careful observer, what are some of the signals you see, you know, and that you're learning to read? Where are you taking some of your clues in how to manage things?
Sure. We can come at that from a couple different angles. So, like the signals telling us when to initiate plant care. So we're looking and being really conscious about when we water, for instance, or fertilizing as well. You know, we try to not use a lot of fertilizer in the landscape, but with unreliable rain, you could fertilize and have that wash off very quickly, not delivering the impact you're hopeful for in your garden.
And do you see certain plants that kind of are, are the early signals, or like the indicators, so to speak, that, uh-oh, this is too much right now? Like, I mean, because I mean, I know I do. I mean, right now, for instance, here it is. It's what, the end of close to the end of the first week of August. I have one fothergilla shrub outside that's already in its full color. It's stressed. It's been under multiple stresses during this. We had very hot and periods of dry and whatever craziness. And so, it's telling me, hey, I've had enough, Mom. I'm
Gonna
kind of
pack it in for the season. Yeah, there's a red maple out in the middle of a field. It was a recent installation, and that red maple right now is in full fall color as well. So absolutely, that early fall color, a lot of the mechanics that cause fall color can be it's simulated whenever there's a drought. So yeah, that is definitely a sign that you look for. And in that theme as well, up here, upstate New York, New England, fall color, the changing of the leaves is a very exciting time of the year. People travel from all over the place, and that is another thing that can be thrown off. When is it as predictable for folks that might need to travel to come see those leaf changing events? It's increasingly unpredictable.
I remember when we did the Times piece also that you were saying that some of the dogwoods are early, like, indicators, like that they can't, that their leaves will curl and things like that earlier. And when you see that, you're like, uh-oh, kind of, and not just for them, right?
Yeah, they're easy communicators, perhaps. They almost seem to enjoy suffering to some extent. They are some of the first trees that are going to show those characteristic water stress habits with flagging foliage, edges starting to curl. And we know that it's a problem when that foliage isn't recovering on an overnight. So if we have very hot nights, insufficient precipitation, we're not seeing the rebound necessarily. So that's another sign for us to initiate some kind of triage.
And sometimes wilting or, curled leaves and things like that, sometimes it's something more serious than inadequate moisture. And sometimes you'll see yellowing of leaves on a tree or a shrub, and people are like, oh, I'm going to fertilize it, it's hungry. And we shouldn't be rushing to judgment. We need to look more closely and maybe get some diagnostic help. Or how do you advise people, not to, as I said, rush to judgment?
Or we have such a capacity for care for the plants. And we can definitely smother them with that love. So too much fertilizer is something that can absolutely cause that. It can lead to a buildup of salts in the soil, or it might not even be necessary. It can initiate a flush of vegetative growth that is now less protected, less resilient to insect or other kind of herbivory. So definitely, if you're seeing some kind of out of the ordinary, like you're saying, yellowing or marginal necrosis or death in the leaves, then a diagnostic test is a great first step. So leaning on those extension networks, nearly every state, well, certainly every state has that extension network for submitting a sample of soil or foliage, determining is it a disease, is it a fungus, is it an insect, low nutrients in the soil, and then you can do what is correct for the plant.
Because I mean, the other thing that's great about contacting your county extension is it's not unusual that they've been hearing a similar observation from 17 other people in the area, at the same time, because the conditions being the same, nearby and so forth. So they may actually, even from a photograph or whatever, oh yes, we've been having a lot of reports of this and such. You know, you may not even in some cases have to wait for a pathology report or whatever. I mean, with the soil things, absolutely you do. But so they have so much insight to share. And I think in these hard times, I think we need to really get to be best friends with our county extension agents in a way that maybe people haven't in recent years, really.
For sure. Totally
yeah.
agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have our eyes wide open. Sometimes we're not seeing good things, but we have our eyes wide open for things, for the signals. With watering, you were talking about how, you know, it's sort of the on or the off switch for you guys. You're and I, same here. It's either we get 3 inches at a time in about 5 minutes, or we get nothing. Are you using different watering tactics, or how do you know when to water? I mean, with the trees and shrubs I'm talking about, especially, and I know they're probably in mixed beds with herbaceous companions and so forth, but how do you kind of decide, or is everything on a schedule, or how does it work?
Sure. So back in 2016, we kind of got caught off guard a little bit with a terrible drought. And this caused us to really do some thinking. We're in the Great Lakes region. This is the land of fresh water. Having a deficit of it, we weren't ready for it. We had no plan. So since then, we've started developing some things to help our collections. One is to prioritize the most important plants in the landscape. If we have a 250-year-old oak, then maybe that's something that we need to prioritize. Mm-hmm. Anything that's newly planted, so something planted in the last 3 or 4 years hasn't developed a robust root network in the face of a very uncommon drought. So those are some of the first things that we start watering. Methods for doing so, we've used the gator bags that can be put around the trunk of a tree. And you fill them with water and it slowly perks into the soil, giving a nice deep watering. Uh-huh. That is an important aspect there as well. So we want to water infrequently, but very deeply.
Yes.
Rather than that everyday watering. With an everyday shallow watering, the roots they're not going to hunt for deeper soil. They're going to stay right at the top. And then when that drought comes, they're going to suffer more.
Right. And so I believe you guys use some soaker hoses and other equipment and so forth, but yes, to get it right there on the root zone.
Yeah, and the root zone can be wider than the drip line of the tree.
Yes.
So the extent of the branches where water would be captured by the leaves and dropped to the ground, roots can be much wider than that. So making sure that we're going wide. We don't want to stay right around the base of a tree. Soaker hoses they're great for us. These, again, slowly percolate down into the soil. We're not watering foliage where the water is going to evaporate before it even makes ground contact. Timing is very important too. So watering on the overnight when there's no sun, it's not causing that water to evaporate. We're setting timers. Right. On our hoses so that watering happens at 3, 4 a.m.
Right. And people could set up drip irrigation on a timer as well if they wanted to. I mean, it's a little more, it's a lot more precise to get it set up than laying out a soaker hose, I would imagine. But that would be another way to get, not be spraying water into the air and to be able to do it on a timer and so forth as well.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, mulch. That's the other thing is I feel like I'm mulching earlier in the spring because I'm concerned that, well, first of all, everything around all my trees and shrubs is going to come poking out of the ground sooner than it ever did. But also because these bouts of dry and even heat can come so much earlier and I want to retain the soil moisture. Are you finding that also that you're putting the mulch down earlier and so far?
Yeah, you nailed it. It's those two aspects. So mulch on the ground, that's going to help insulate the soil from water loss and from temperature fluctuations. So very important in that regard. Doing it early is a must as well. With changes in phenology, when things are breaking bud or when plants are coming out of the ground or when they flower, we need to make sure that that mulch is on the ground so that we're not having to lift every leaf as we try to get that mulch contact with the ground.
Right. I know probably people ask you this all the time, but you know, you see so many different recommendations. How deep is too deep or the right depth or whatever? I mean, what's the guidance that you would give us for the depth of mulch? And also tell us a little bit about what you use as mulch, because you use a very interesting mix of materials.
Sure. Yeah. Mulching depth for us, our goals are, well, we have several goals. One is weed suppression, temperature fluctuation. So trying to hit all of those goals, usually 2 to 4 inches of mulch is going to serve our needs. When it comes to trees, you really want to keep that mulch away from the base of the tree, that trunk flare where it connects with the ground. And with many perennials as well, you know, any mulch against the base of it can retain too much moisture and lead to issues for the plants.
Right.
So yeah, 2 to 4 inches usually does it for us.
Okay.
The kind of mulch that we're using, we have, it's all made on campus here. So it's a combination of leaf collection that happens in the fall. Mm-hmm. Those leaves are composted, turned into leaf mold, and then that is combined with the chips that we produce from tree removals. So anything that goes through our chipper, it's usually branch wood. We don't have a very large chipper. So this branch wood yields a product called Ramiel wood chips. Oh. These have an excellent ratio of the living parts of the tree that are much more nutritious when composted. A better ratio of that material to the heartwood. So it's, just an excellent product, especially for woody plants.
So Ramiel wood chips, and those are from the small and medium branches that have been ground up, so to speak, in the machine, huh?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to heartwood. Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of places recommend, you know, arborist wood chips, and I think, what's that all about? I guess partly that they're free, but this is this is sort of a subdivision of that, because that could also involve whole tree trunks.
Yeah, for sure. It depends on the size of the chipper that material is going into. And for a lot of companies, it is easier to chip that material than it is to load it on a truck and transport it. So they're going to chip as much as they can. But it's still a very nutritious product for the plants.
Right. Again, when we did the Times column, we talked about, so say you have a bed that, and I know I've seen this, plants that I used to read about that in the southeastern United States, they needed afternoon shade. Well, in Margaret's northeastern garden these days, I think they need afternoon shade in peak summer. You know what I mean? It's caught up. It seems like it's just so much more intense. And so I kind of wish in certain areas that I could create some shade, sort of modify the habitat a little bit. And you kind of had some suggestions for ways we could do that either temporarily or in a little more semi-permanent way. And so that's another possibility, yes.
For sure. Yeah. In the short term, if you need that shade right now, then using shade cloth is a great way to get that kind of dappled sun, so it's not the full energy bearing down on foliage.
Right, and especially with like newly planted things and so forth. I mean, they're just going to fry otherwise, and that's shade cloth is a great way to give them a kind of microclimate under there as opposed to out in the baking sun.
Much of our plant material originates from our plant production facility, and we have a lath house there.
Oh.
So as you were talking about with changes in the early season going from winter to summer almost immediately, those lath structures are helping us harden those plants off. And if they've already been put out into the landscape, then shade cloth can get them there as well.
Yeah. And planting something to create shade, planting what, an evergreen or something like that to create shade, not right away, but eventually, like modifying our garden design in a sense.
Sure. Yeah. Trees.
Cast. Yeah.
More plant trees, more trees. That southwestern side is great, helping to give plants that afternoon shade they need. It depends on the siting of your garden. You may not want to plant a conifer necessarily. There's a lot of solar gain that you can get when in the middle of winter you want the sun to hit your house and give you a little bit of solar gain there. So yeah, knowing your site, talking to your extension department and seeing if they can make any suggestions.
Right, to identify, but it's first like sort of identifying, trying to put the problem into words so that you can express it and say, I have this bed of X, Y, and Z, and it's in the afternoon, I'm noticing, you know, this is happening, and, you know, more consistently in the summers and so forth. So to really, you know, kind of go around and take some notes, I feel like that's what I'm doing anyway, is I'm looking for what's not working anymore. Because you certain things we can't fight at all, and other things we can give them some help, like we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
Did you, half the country in late last November, I think, half the country moved a half a zone, 5 degrees in the winter, what is that, the mean winter low or something? I always get confused how to express the what the zones mean. But the USDA published their new plant hardiness zone map, and half the country moved a half a zone. I moved from 5B to 6A. I think you guys moved two up at the Botanic Gardens. And
yes, we also went from 5B to 6A. Further downtown in Ithaca, it's another half zone warmer yet frequently.
Wow. So, I mean, I guess with all this havoc, the one for gardeners, one of the silver linings, if we could put that in air quotes or whatever, is that theoretically we have a wider palette of things winter hardiness wise that we can grow. Are you experimenting with, are you pushing the zones a little bit further and trying some new things there?
Absolutely. Yeah. I moved up here from Philadelphia. So I went from a 7B to a 5B gardening zone. And there are some things that I am just absolutely in love with. So yeah, taking a hold of that opportunity, and we're trying a few different things. Lagostromia, for instance, crepe myrtles. We introduced that to the collection this year. It's a tiny little shrubby one, but it flowered for us. You know, it was planted last year and overwintered happily and flowered. So,
wow,
that's pretty exciting. Yeah, wow. And we're going to continue trialing out, pushing it wherever we can, finding those microclimates that can support a half to a whole zone more as well. Poliothyrosis was another recent introduction, and it had received some winter damage its first and second year, but it's getting pretty established now. I think it'll be just fine.
I don't even know the common name for that. Does it even have one? I don't know.
It's Chinese pearl bloom, I think.
Huh. Okay, I'm gonna look it up. It's a new one. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. So you are trying definitely some new things, but trying is the important. We can't guarantee that just because our zone's been changed that it's like rock solid, you know, that we're not going to have some disappointments. So we're going to try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it only improves with time too. So this winter for us, we far exceeded a 6A winter. Our low temperature, I think, was 3 degrees. So
yes.
When we have winters like that, two or three in a row, that gives the opportunity for plants to really establish, get a resilient root network. And then when it does return to, you know, marginally 6A, then something 6B, 7A might make it anyways because it's established.
Yeah. So in the last 2-3 minutes, I just want to, speaking of planting new things, proper planting technique with our woody plants is going to be more important than ever. Like, there's no wiggle room with all these other stressors to be stressed by a bad planting job. And yet when I buy a young tree or shrub at the garden center, I can't just pull it out of the pot and stick that root mass in the ground at all. That's not going to work. And I wonder if you can give us description, it's really important to do some work on the roots first and get them in the right position. Yes.
For sure. For sure. You can save many future headaches with a well-planted plant. So firstly, planting when the plant is dormant is advised if you can swing it. So before it leaves out, when you pull a plant out of a pot, you don't want to immediately put it right into the ground. Those roots have been in this non-natural environment. They've reached out for a wide root network, hit the side of the pot, and started spiraling around. So I try to nearly bare root every plant that I can, repeatedly dunking it in a wheelbarrow of water, for instance. Mm-hmm. I can get a lot of the soil off of that root mass and then tease those roots to where they want to go, which is wider.
Right, right. Spread out. Yeah.
Depth is another very important aspect. We want that plant to be stable in the ground. Far too often we plant too deeply. We want to have the root flare, the place where the trunk begins to flare out into the roots. We want that at or just slightly above soil grade. Okay. I've been planting above soil grade recently because we anticipate adding a few layers of mulch for right. several years during that tree's establishment. So planning for that so that they don't get buried on year 10, for instance.
Right, right. Well, I just think it's really important for people to know that the level it's at in the pot is probably not the level it's supposed to be at in the ground.
It's very rare that it is.
No, no. So, well, Daniel, I hope you're going to come back and talk to us about other things that are going on up there, because, again, I think those of us backyard gardeners need advice more and more all the time, for better or worse. But it's great to speak to you again, and I hope all is well up there. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you for the opportunity, and good luck with your afternoon.
Thank you. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.